Chris Brancato is here with us today. I am so excited to have him on the show. For those of you who don't know who Chris Brancato is, I don't know, you're living under a rock or something, but Chris Brancato is a writer, producer, creator. He created Narcos, which I love that show. I could not even believe when I met you, when I told my agent, said, yeah, this guy's doing this thing, Godfather of Harlem with Forrest Whitaker. I said, oh, I love Forrest. I said, well, what about the writer? I want to know what he's done. They said, Narcos. I said, Narcos? Narcos, Narcos? And he said, yeah. And I said, I'm in. I want to meet him. I got to go there, set it up. I don't care what it is. And I know that's how we met. I know.
Well, I had that same feeling when they said, hey, you're going to get to meet with Chaz Palminteri. I said, okay. I'm putting on the big boy shoes here and going to get one of the best actors I know. And
thanks, Chris. Thank you. Chris, I have to ask you a question before we get into all these things. Here's a guy who grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. Okay. You graduated Brown University. Where does a guy graduate Brown University, Ivy League school? How could you write about organized crime the way you do? You didn't grow up in the Bronx like I did. How did that happen?
Well, it's interesting. That's a very good question because, no, my upbringing was completely and totally removed from the worlds that I like to write about. I think it was, you know, first of all, it was a fascination with gangster movies. I mean, really from The Godfather on to Scarface and all the classics. And so I think that as a writer, that I always gravitated towards that material as a viewer. And so as I started to learn my craft, just my interest naturally shifted towards those kind of movies I wanted to see. And so, you know, for me, on the one hand, you can have a lived experience as you did in order to write A Bronx Tale. And on another hand, research and studying the people and getting a vibe as to what the landscape is, be it Columbia of the 80s or Harlem of the 60s, you know, that's the writer's job, is to put themselves into that world as best they can. If they didn't live it themselves, then you have to try to process it through the stories other people tell you, and also, of course, through your own imagination. So, you know, that's kind of why I think I learned the craft of writing, and I applied that. I could write science fiction. I could write pretty much anything but comedy, really, because comedy is not my forte. But in terms of taking what I know about how to write a script and then simply trying to put myself in that world through research, I read a lot of books about Pablo Escobar. I interviewed people who chased him. I interviewed people who worked for him, and then you try to get a picture of those people in your head, and then you try to write them as best you can.
Was he well liked, Chris, in his country? Did a lot of people love him and a lot of people hated him? Was that how it was?
Well, it was very interesting. I went to Medellin to start to do some research, and as we were flying, I landed in Bogota at first, and then we were flying on a little jumper plane to Medellin, and the person I was sitting next to on the airplane said to me, they saw me looking at a script, you know, they said, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm here working and researching a project. It's called Narcos. It's the story of Pablo Escobar, and the person got a very grim look on their face, and they said, you know, my mother's second husband was killed by Escobar. He was a judge, and he said that man has caused grievous harm to this country. And then I landed in Medellin, and there was a driver there to take us to the hotel. And the driver, speaking in Spanish, and then there was somebody who could translate. We got to the hotel, and as we were getting out, the driver said through the translator, hey, I just wanted to tell you that when I was 18 years old, I worked for Pablo Escobar. He was the nicest man. We all fought to serve his table when he had parties, because he'd give $100 tips. So that, you know, within the span of a couple of hours in Colombia, I heard one person who hated him and another person who adored him. And that's, I think, the way he was for the country. Obviously, one of the things, observations that we make in Narcos is when you're making so much money through illegal activities, you start to not even know what to do with the money. So you give it back to the poor, and that makes them love you. And so right. that's what he did. And there's no doubt he had a certain charisma and charm, but overall, I can't say that he was a good human being.
Well, he did kill many people. So that alone tells you that, you know, and that's the beauty about, I love about your writing is that you make these people, you know, it was funny when I was watching Narcos, I hated him, but there's a part of you that roots for him. And I go, how did he do this? How did, you know, and I think that's your brilliance as a writer. And now, you know, segueing to the series that you created, Godfather of Harlem, which obviously I want to talk about, with Forest Whitaker and Vincent D'Onofrio and Paul Sorvino, Giancarlo Esposito, Catherine Narducci. Oh, my God, so many great people.
Annabella
and Bumpy's wife.
Ilfinesh Adera.
Ilfinesh. In fact, Ilfinesh is going to be on. She's going to be on in a little while. Ilfinesh is so, I mean, I always go, how could someone that beautiful be that good of an actress? You know, it's like, wow. You know, but so many great people on it. What made you think of like, well, I'm going to write about Bumpy Johnson?
Well, first of all, there's something to say back to what you talked about rooting for Escobar. When I was in Medellin on that trip I was telling you about, I was also going to have dinner with Wagner Mora, who plays Pablo, because he was in Medellin going to university to brush up on his Spanish, because he's Brazilian and he speaks Brazilian Portuguese, and he was brushing up on his Spanish to do the series. So when I went to the dinner place we were meeting, he stood up. We hadn't met each other before. And as I went to shake his hand, I thought, this guy's face, his whole demeanor is so accessible. I thought to myself, this is perfect. He's going to do awful things, but you're going to feel like you have to root for him, because that's just the way he conveys himself. And to your point, a lot of it has to do with the writing, but just as much of it has to do with the actor that you get to fill the shoes. So that on Godfather of Harlem, this murderer's row of actors you've just described, yourself included, are to me what breathe life into the words. I get you guys imprinted on my DNA. So that, for instance, when I'm writing Joseph Bonanno, I'm kind of filtering it through the way you perform it. When I'm writing Bumpy Johnson, I'm filtering it through the way Forrest performs it, or Costello, I'm thinking about Sorvino. And the actor actually kind of invades my brain, and I imagine them delivering the lines, whatever their chosen method of interpreting the character is. So it's a real back and forth, Chaz. It's on the one hand, I have things to accomplish in the scene. As a writer, I have things to accomplish in the script as a whole. But then it's also about this unique kind of symbiosis I have with the actor playing it. So, for example, when you and I sat down to meet, there were actually a couple of roles that I thought you were great for, either Costello or perhaps Bonanno. And I'm glad we ended up with Bonanno, because I think that that's a role that allows for your dynamism to shine through. And also, I love the scenes between you and Vincent D'Onofrio. I mean, that's just, yes, it's pure gold. In terms of the show, I had written a movie in the 90s. One of my very good friends and the co-creator of Godfather of Harlem is Paul Eckstein, an African-American guy who I went to Brown with. And when we got out of college, he said to me, he knew I wanted to be a movie writer. He was an actor. And he said, you know, Chris, I watch movies like The Godfather and I see Michael Corleone. I watch Scarface and I see Al Pacino playing Tony Montana. It's funny that, you know, Al Pacino plays Michael Corleone and then he goes and plays Tony Montana. But but he said, you know, there was a black gangster in Harlem named Bumpy Johnson who put my grandmother through secretarial school. He paid for her education. And this guy was the Don of Harlem, and nobody's ever written anything about him. He's an unknown figure, but trust me, he was essentially the godfather of Harlem. And I said, wow, that's fascinating. And he asked me to write a movie about him, which I resisted for a number of years. I didn't feel like the story necessarily, you know, I didn't want to. He was advocating telling the whole story of Bumpy's long life, which was three or four decades of right. of being the Don. And ultimately in the 90s, I decided, hey, let me take a crack at just a little segment of his life. In the 1930s, Bumpy Johnson fought against Lucky Luciano and Dutch Schultz for control of the Harlem Numbers. So I thought that that was interesting. A guy who's sticking up and trying to protect the numbers bank of a female numbers operator named Madame Stephanie St. Clair. And so I wrote that movie, and we were lucky enough to get Lawrence Fishburne to play Bumpy Johnson. Cicely Tyson was Stephanie St. Clair. Andy Garcia played Lucky Luciano. Tim Roth played Dutch Schultz. This is a movie that was called Hoodlum. And interestingly enough, it didn't make a huge splash at the box office, other than the fact that the African-American audience really dug it. It continues to play all the time in reruns and such. So cut to 22 years later, a couple of producers come to me and say, hey, do you want to do Bumpy Johnson in the 60s? And Forrest Whitaker might be interested in playing him. And my first thought was, nah, you know, I've already done the character. What is there anything more to say? You know, oh, he's going to fight against the Italians. And if you're, you know, it'll be like the movie, you know, he ends up outfoxing the Italians. And, you know, I've done it before. But then I started to look a little bit more about Bumpy Johnson's life in the 60s. And I realized that he had been very good friends with Malcolm X. They played chess together. They were pals. They knew each other from back in the day when Malcolm was a hustler on the streets of Harlem in the late 40s. And it hit me. The show could be a show that deals with the collision of the underworld and the civil rights movement. In other words, we get a chance to use the form of a gangster show and all the stuff we all love about gangster shows. But if you add this relationship with Malcolm X in there and the push for civil rights, and the show could become a platform where we could discuss all kinds of things that are going on today. And we could also take the ability to, you know, there's a, you know, for me, shows are interesting when you present a balanced view. So that, for instance, Chin and Bonanno and some of these other guys, there has to be a grain of truth to their complaints about what's going on. It can't just be you're painting the white people as racist and the black people as heroic. You have to actually try to create a tableau where we're examining these people in the context of their lives. So that, for example, the Italians may use the N-word to describe the African-Americans, but the African-Americans use the G-word, Guineas, to describe the Italians. So that it's, you know, in other words, this right. is about how people separate into tribal groups, and that often causes trouble. There's, you know, tribalism has its benefits, but it also has its negatives. And so I think the show became something that when we went to go sell it, the executives had never heard of anything like this before. You know, they hadn't heard about a show that's also going to deal with crime and civil rights. And what we've managed to do here, Chaz, is, you know, then what became great was, well, we had Forrest Whitaker. So, you know, then when you're setting the bar that high, then you can call a Sorvino or a Pamenteri or Giancarlo Esposito. You, in other words, now the big boys and the big girls come out to play, because you're starting right. with this Oscar-winning actor there at the top, and and it was a dream come true for me. I mean, look at this cast. It's a miracle.
I love going to work every day. I love acting with everybody. I love the writing. What you say is, I love the scenes between Malcolm and Bumpy. I'm not even in those scenes, but I just love watching it. When I watch the show, I don't know if their friendship was that close, but boy, I have to tell you, those scenes just knocked me out. And the actor who plays Malcolm X,
Nigel Thatch,
who is just, oh my God, you know, he was so great. He played Malcolm X in Selma, if I'm not
mistaken. That's right. Yeah, and I have to say this. I mean, obviously, a lot of great actors, including Denzel Washington, have played Malcolm X, but I think Nigel gives every single one of them a real run for their money. He not only looks like him, but he's a phenomenal actor. And I think, you know, I look at the series a little bit like Bumpy Johnson is a heroin dealer. You know, he is not helping the community. And right. Yet the show examines why he feels that's given the lack of economic opportunity afforded to blacks at that time, why he justifies his existence as a drug dealer by being a philanthropist, by being somebody who throws, you know, the Christmas party every year where turkeys are given out. But over the course of the stretch of the multiple seasons, knocking on wood here, we want to see the education of Bumpy Johnson. We want to see a guy who starts to realize that what he's doing actually has a negative effect on the community. We want to see him take ownership of the fact that he's a criminal and hopefully find some kind of redemption at the end of the arc. So, look,
Fascinating. That's what I love about the show. It's not black and white. It's gray and gray. You know, Bumpy is as great as he is. Obviously, he's doing harm to the community. The civil rights, as bad as it was, then you get the other side. And then as Bumpy's growing, the civil rights is changing. I mean, it was a brilliant concept, I have to say. And as soon as the producer said, I never heard anything like this, that should have told you right there, this is a hit. When I write something and they love it too much, I get nervous.
Well, right. Well, listen, I mean, you know as well or better than I do that when you land on an idea that at its core, look, a Bronx Tale is about a young man who's basically caught between two fathers, you know, and at the time you wrote that, it was an entirely novel concept. You took the traditional sort of coming of age story crossed with a gangster epic and then turned it on its ear to be something emotional. I've obviously seen the movie multiple times, but also your one-man show, which really, truly is in some ways the crystallized, most beautiful form of that story, is you playing those different roles. But the fact of the matter is, I think we're living in a world, Chaz, where like, in some ways, everybody's seen everything. We're so bombarded with all different shows, we're seeing every movies, we have streaming services, et cetera. And so the only way you're going to cut through, you know, I call a good idea a fog cutter. It cuts through all the fog and all the surrounding shows. And it's an idea it's got elements that we're familiar with. Like, for instance, a civil rights story or a gangster story. But you haven't seen the two things together. And you haven't seen actors portraying, you know, Johnson and Malcolm X. Or you haven't seen Bonanno and Chin together in very many movies. You haven't seen Bonanno, Chin, and Bumpy Johnson together. And right. So, you know, it's finding ways to do stuff that the audience relates to and loves, but not making it just this repetitive thing that we've all seen before. And listen, the mob world, like, you know, forget about it. It's so easy to do the tropey mob story that we've all seen before.
Right. You're right. But that's what makes Godfather of Harlem so unique. And the amazing thing of his first season was incredible. I think the second season's even better. I mean, it's just like it's just exploding. We're learning more about the characters and the voice and the idea you put this hip hop, this music that's from today in that world. And you go, No, that's not going to work. It works. It works. It works gangbusters. And you go, I don't understand it, but it's just, Chris, I'm so proud to be in this show. I'm so proud to be a part of it. I hope it runs for so many, for many, many years. And I can't wait for more people to even watch it, because it's so great.
Well, keep this in mind. There's a couple of things that happened with regard to the second season. As we were preparing to sit down and start to write the second season, we got delayed by COVID, but also right. The thing happened with George Floyd. And suddenly race relations in this country took on a new, you know, became much more part of the national conversation right. than had been the case in the first year. And as writers, we felt, you know what, we're going to have to address some of these issues, the issues of police brutality, voter suppression. We're going to have to look at these different things through the lens of our show. Another thing happened as well. COVID forced us to make the show a little more contained. We couldn't be out there on the streets filming all the time. So for instance, we built the Joe Bonanno's living room set. We built Chin's kitchen. We built Malcolm X's home. We actually made the show smaller. And sometimes when you make a show smaller, you actually have to delve deeper and further right. into the characters. So for example, we never met Bonanno's wife in the first year. We never met Malcolm's wife. And so now we see the inside of those people's home lives, and it gives us a sense of more depth. So there's that. Then in terms of the music, we were nervous at the beginning. Well, hold on a second. Some people are going to hate that we're sticking contemporary urban music on a period show. But what we had was, like I said, we had a murderer's row of some of the greatest actors, the greatest actors in America, but also some of the greatest iconic actors from movies that are mob movies, you, Sorvino, et cetera, Narducci, you know, et cetera. And so it was like, how do we make this again? How do we make it feel different? And how do we also potentially make it feel connected to today's younger audience? Because, you know, we wanted people who are 20 somethings to watch it as well. And so we got this guy Swizz Beatz, who's a music producer of some, you know, skill and talent to yeah. And what he does is he looks at the film. You know, we will send him a cut of a particular sequence where, and he'll select the right beat, and then he'll find the right rapper to come in, and then they create the lyrics up on the spot.
Wow.
for the you know, based on how the film makes them feel. And it's been very, very successful, and the songs that get released off of the show have been very, very successful as well. So well,
Chris, it's just amazing. It's an amazing accomplishment. I love the show, and I people love it, and everybody I speak to, young people love it. They I see them come over to me and say, oh, I love you on the show, and I say thank you. And they love Forrest, Vincent and Paul, everyone. Giancarlo Esposito kills that character.
He's so funny.
He's just amazing. So I want to thank you for being on the show.
Actually,
Chris,
I have one question.
Oh wait, my producer Michael has a question for you, Chris.
You're so brilliant at what you do. I always am curious, is there anything you've written that you regret or cringe at that you put out there?
Oh, you know, I cringe at almost everything I write, you know, whether it's good or bad. You know, that's the nature of being a writer. You know, I've certainly done my fair share of stuff back in the, you know, earlier on in my career that was, you know, network television stuff that I'm not particularly proud of. At the same time, you know, I'm old enough to have written on the original Beverly Hills 90210. So it's funny when I go to my cousins, you know, out in Long Island, the younger women, you know, they don't give a damn about Narcos or Godfather of Harlem. They're just like, he's the guy who wrote Beverly Hills 90210. But yeah, I mean, look, we all take shots at stuff. And what I came to discover, and I think Chaz will second this, You know, when I was trying to write to sell things to other people and figure out what the studio, what the network wanted, when I tried to figure out what you wanted, I'd invariably write something that neither of us wanted. And then when I started to ask myself, what are the things that interest me as a viewer? What do I want to see? What themes do I want to explore? What movies do I like? And then I started to, you know, aim my writing towards those things. Well, my writing got better, and my interest in the writing got more. I think that's the key to it.
That is the key. Before we close, I want to. I remember we were doing a scene, Forrest and I, and it was that incredible scene you wrote about. I think they just put it in a rap song.
The darkest scene I've ever written.
Chaz, I don't know where I was. I was in this dark place. And I remember we talked about, because I had to use the N-word, and the producers, the studio didn't want me to use it. And I said, I have to use it. I said, I can't do this. And I remember I called you and you said, don't worry, do it. I'll handle it. And I love you for that, because it just wouldn't have been right by not using it, because that character in that time would have said that, you know. And I remember what Arthur Miller once told me, the great writer, Arthur Miller, where I was in a workshop of his, View from the Bridge. And we were talking one day, because I was picking his brain about writing, because I'm with Arthur Miller, you know. And he said to me, I never forgot it, Chris. He said, when you're writing, he said, that you say to yourself, oh my God, I can't write this. I just can't. He goes, that's when you're supposed to write it. He goes, because that's where the goal is. And I never forgot that.
That's exactly right. And that particular thing that you say, which is your joy of spreading drug addiction upon the Black community because of a grievance you have, the belief that your son was killed by a Black gang. You know, that's one of the darkest things I've ever written. It does take a certain amount of, you know, I had an intuitive sense that was going to resonate with people as you know, and it certainly did. As you say, some rapper took that segment and put it in a rap song. You know, I've seen much Twitter commentary about that. And what's interesting is people aren't criticizing that we did that. They're actually saying, wow, you guys had the bravery to touch upon something so dark. And so, you know, I think you're right about that, Chaz. I think you have to go to places. The show has to go to uncomfortable places. You
absolutely
know?
Well, Chris Brancato, you are a treasure to this industry. Thank you so much. Thank you for allowing me to be in your wonderful series, Godfather of Harlem. It was a real pleasure having you. And I just can't get over somebody smart as you went to Brown University can write like this.
That's all. Well, thank you so much. And I'm privileged to have you on the show, and also to be here on your podcast. Thank you, Chaz.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.